All right, thanks, Vincent. If you happened to come 3 weeks ago when I gave another lecture, that was hopefully that was somewhat entertaining. This is not really intended to be entertaining. I thought maybe I would actually try and be pedagogical, but I didn't make a real strong effort at that either. But what I did do, maybe most of you noticed, was ask for questions about mostly spin liquids, frustrated. I asked about questions about anything, more or less, and almost all the questions are about spin liquids, so mostly I thought it makes sense to talk about spin liquids. And I'm going to try and make this sort of like a question and answer session. If you looked at the questions on the wiki space, you still could. If you've got your laptop here or your iPhone or whatever. They're a pretty interesting and pretty widely varied set of questions, so I thought that was pretty stimulating. So what I'd like to do is just kind of structure this like a question and answer session. I'll start off with what I think are sort of the simple questions, or at least more basic questions, and provide a little bit of background that I think goes with them, and then depending how we do, we'll go on to as some of the more complicated questions. Some of the questions are just very either difficult to understand what the questions are, or advanced enough that I certainly don't feel qualified to answer them. But there are a lot of experts in the audience also, so if you think I'm saying something that is inadequate or you have a better explanation, by all means, chime in. This is not that well prepared. So I'm gonna, like I said, I wanna structure this as sort of a question and answer thing. So the first question was up there, which is a pretty good question, is there a simple definition of a spin liquid? So the answer answer is yes or no, or I'm not sure actually. I think a reasonable answer is yes, but there are too many. Too many definitions. So this is kind of a cheat. Let me try and address why it's actually sort of hard to define a spin liquid. We can try and come up with some reasonable definitions that are good for some purposes or not for others. And in the process, I'll kind of answer the question, hopefully answer the question at some simple level, at least, what is a spin liquid? Okay, it's a similar thing. So the simplest level you could try and address this question is just the kind of colloquial level. Which is what an experimentalist might mean, okay? We have maybe one experimentalist in here. I saw Ian at some point, maybe he left already.
Not leaving now.
Not really? Good. Yeah, it's a theory institution. So that colloquial definition is just a state in which we have correlated, but still fluctuating spins. Okay. Slightly more precisely, what an experimentalist might look for is to see that local moments exist, okay? So do spins really exist? We'd want to check that. For instance, you could look experimentally in a condensed matter system, you could look for the presence of a Curie law in susceptibility, okay, which is a kind of direct indication of the presence of local moments. Everyone knows what a Curie law is, I guess. We're not going to pitch this too low. And the fact that they're fluctuating, we mean that there's no ordering down to some low, we have to define what low means, temperature. Okay. So of course, you know, in an experiment, we can never get to absolute zero temperature, so low should just mean low relative to some characteristic temperature. We mean anomalously low, lower than we would expect ordering to happen at. And there's kind of an empirical way that people in experiment tend to look for this in a magnetic system, which is to say, if the temperature is well below the what's known as a Curie-Weiss temperature, which basically characterizes the strength of magnetic interaction. So you can think of it as T much less than J in a spin model. So that's, you know, kind of a hand-wavy definition. So we could try and probe a little bit more and ask what this means. So you know, the next question you might ask is what does fluctuating mean? Okay. So we typically think about two different kinds of fluctuations. We could mean real fluctuations. Amongst different states. Basically we mean entropy. Fluctuations that are characterized by real entropy. Okay. So there are spin liquids, which are what I usually call classical spin liquids. You know, where this is what's going on. You have some spins that, for whatever reason, maybe their interactions are complicated in some way. They don't find an easy way to order, so they're really flipping around, changing from one state to another, and exploring their phase space. Okay. And this, probably the best example of this, which has gotten a lot of press recently, is this nice spin ice. Boy, this is really hard to read things here. It's nice spin ice materials that Roderick over there and others have worked on a lot. Probably for the purpose of this, these workshops, you're more interested in actually what people call quantum fluctuations, or what would be going on really at zero temperature. And you know, here, really, this has nothing to do with entropy. There's no entropy. System is in its ground state. So what we really mean by fluctuations is that the spins are in a superposition state. And so if somehow we have a system which remains, which is a spin liquid at zero temperature, we call that a quantum spin liquid. Okay, that's mostly what I'll be talking about, trying to answer questions about. This is somehow a system in which the ground state is some very complicated superposition of many, many different spin configurations in such a way that there's no actual ordering of those spins. That's kind of delocalized over the space of different spin configurations. Okay. Maybe that's a sort of good empirical definition of what a spin liquid is, or a quantum spin liquid is, one in which spins are sort of delocalized over many spin configurations. But really, we should do better than that. Problem is, there are actually lots of sort of trivial examples. Actually, many of them are interesting, but from the point of view of thinking about quantum spin liquids, they're trivial. For instance, kind of nice set of examples to think about, which we would probably not like to call a quantum spin liquid, are kind of spin dimer systems. A number of these have been explored. These are, unlike quantum spin liquids, these have definitely been found in the laboratory in very clear-cut fashion. A sort of famous example is thallium copper chloride, for instance. So these are materials where you have sort of pairs of spins that have stronger interactions, if you want, between the pairs. Kind of spin here and spin here. And they, if they have antiferromagnetic interactions between them, they can form singlets like this. And so the ground state is sort of simple. It's trivial in the sense that basically these two spins are just entangled with one another, and these are entangled with one another. So the ground state is sort of approximately a product state. When I draw this thing, I mean the spin singlet state, like this. If the first spin is this one, and the second spin is this one, so this kind of satisfies these constructions. You know, this is a unique quantum state. There's no entropy. The spins are in a superposition state. The spins are not ordered. But this is certainly not what anyone would call a quantum spin liquid. Okay. Usually we call these things various names: a dimer state, valence bond, solid. There are various different variations on this, in which in some materials like thallium copper chloride, there are very specific pairs of spins that are close to one another because of the crystal structure, and so there's no choice in as to which other spin this spin forms a singlet with. So there's really a unique ground state. There's more complicated examples, at least in models, where the system has to spontaneously choose which spins should be paired up with one another, so that these dimer states break some symmetries. But still, the kind of ground state wave function is still basically a product state of dimers. Sometimes we call these things valence bond crystals. That might differentiate the two. Okay. So these may or may not break symmetries, but still, this is something that probably we don't want to call a quantum spin liquid. So we can try and do better and try and make general definition. I'll make a stab at it, and then eventually stop trying to define it and talk about sort of what's interesting. So one way thing we can try and do is exclude these trivial cases. Okay, so here's a few attempts to do that. So one thing we can do is use these same definitions, but then we can require that we have a half integer spin per unit cell. Okay. So there's no way we can make a singlet state out of a set of spins having a total spin of a half integer. We can only make Cramer's theorem prevents us from making unique ground state that way. Okay. Or in a more general model, if we're material, we maybe don't exactly know how to count spins, but we know how to count electrons. We could require an odd number of electrons per unit cell. Okay. And by unit cell, I mean unit cell of the ground state. Okay. It might be that our Hamiltonian has some higher symmetry, but the ground state breaks some symmetries. So we mean unit cell of the ground state. So this is sort of a reasonable definition. A lot of people probably use this definition. But it seems a bit disconnected from the concept. So I don't like it that much. I think it's okay, but it's a little bit, it's probably over-restrictive. And you know, we've seen already examples in the disentangling workshop of a possible quantum spin liquid state that doesn't satisfy this on the honeycomb lattice, which is an integer spin or two electrons per unit cell. So a definition I like a little better is a state satisfying all these things, but which is not adiabatically connected. And then we have to define what adiabatically connected is, so there's always some vagueness in this thing. To a band insulator. again, with the same symmetries as the ground state. Okay. So this is probably a better definition. It just means it's something which cannot be, which carries some sort of subtlety, which is more than just a trivial band insulating state.
For a spin system, what do you mean by a band insulator?
For a spin system, what do I mean by a band insulator? Well, I have to talk about what it means to have adiabatic continuity. It's a little bit tricky.
Okay.
If we allow ourselves to always talk about electronic models, I think this is a well-defined thing. And we can obtain basically any spin system we want as a limit of such electronic model, but I'm not sure I know how to go backwards. Okay.
Even within an electronic model, is a Mott insulator adiabatically connected to a band?
Mott insulator doesn't, you have to tell me more information than just Mott insulator. You have to tell me details of what the actual ground state is. Okay, so most Mott insulators, let's say a Nail state, a half-filled Hubbard model on a square lattice is a Nail state. Okay, so, but it breaks symmetries. It breaks time reversal symmetry and it breaks translational symmetry. It has a doubled magnetic unit cell. If I consider a free fermion model with those symmetries, so broken time reversal and broken translational symmetry, the same symmetries as the ground state of that Hubbard model, I would claim that there's a free fermion model has all the same properties as that ground state, and those ground states are adiabatically connected to one another. There's subtleties with it in the sense that the only subtleties you have is that it's a broken symmetry state, and because of that, there are Goldstone modes. And so there's certain long-range correlations associated with that, which probably wouldn't be there if I rigidly fix the staggered magnetization. But I think that's a detail. So we could try and tweak this definition, but I think at least morally, that's sort of the right. That's correct.
How about the AKLT state on this definition?
How about the AKLT state? I would say the AKLT state is equivalent to a band insulator of a certain type. That would be my feeling. But I think you can construct, you probably can construct, I don't know, I'm BSing here, but I think it's most likely it is equivalent in some way. It's certainly not, we wouldn't call this a quantum spin liquid. And I think, you know, you can easily imagine that I can take a model of electrons and pair them up into sort of singlets in this way. So I think probably it is, it doesn't satisfy this definition, I think. Okay. Again, there's the issue that I don't actually know how to define adiabatic continuity between a spin Hamiltonian and one which is not a spin Hamiltonian. So, a different sort of definition you could try and say is it's a state that somehow, which can't be somehow qualitatively different from a direct product state, from any direct product state. And I don't mean a direct product of sites, but a direct product of arbitrarily large clusters. I think that some definition like that is sort of a reasonable one, but I'm not quite sure how to make that work. And then the AKLT probably wouldn't satisfy that definition. So.
In Hamiltonian, could you do something like whether it's connected adiabatically to the high temperature limit? So whether you have to have a phase transition of some sort as you heat up the system?
I don't think so. So there's certainly many spin liquid states which have no phase transition at any non-zero temperature on heating them up to the paramagnet. Then you can ask whether there is a phase transition as temperature hits zero. Whether you call the temperature going to zero a transition or not. But then I'm not sure how you define the presence or absence of a transition at that point. So the, you know, the free energy, I'm not sure has any singularity generically on doing that. I don't know. So you can ask that. So would that definition apply to the simplest fully gapped quantum spin liquid state or not? Okay. I suspect that that's not a very good definition for that reason, but okay, we can look. So you know, the answer is there are too many and none of them are ideal probably. If there are more suggestions, I'm not trying to, maybe one could make that work, but I would think that there are issues with it.
I mean, it doesn't seem rather restricted to allow all kinds of ordering, and couldn't you have sort of, you know, some Tarski system, you know?
Yes, I agree. Well, I'm not rule. This definition doesn't rule out ordering.
I mean, the
okay.
So I guess in the this is not
yeah.
The definition.
Yeah. Right. So I agree. It's overly restrictive. Okay. But it's certainly what people mean when they say spin liquid. Okay. Yeah. Colloquially.
So you do want to include absence of long-range order, is that?
I want to include absence of magnetic ordering in this kind of definition, but we can. So I want to a little bit change gears now and try and say that this focus on absence of ordering is maybe not the right focus. You know, it is sort of where the idea of spin liquid comes from. But you know, absence. So I think a good point to make though is that absence of ordering in and of itself is not that interesting. I mean, you know, certainly if you're an experimentalist, the most boring thing that can happen is nothing, right? it's pretty unsatisfying to try and define something by what it isn't. And so, you know, I think it's really better to try and focus on what the interesting unusual properties are of the quantum spin liquid. Okay. Rather than the lack of them. Okay. So even there, it's not so clear, you know, how you should try and use this to define a quantum spin liquid. I'm going to try and get away from the kind of semantic issue of definition and just talk about things that are, let's say, at least common properties of all the quantum spin liquids that we know. Okay. So one sort of very typical property of quantum spin liquid is that it's a state with some fractional excitations. What's fractional could mean fractional quantum numbers, fractional charge, fractional spin, or statistics, or both.
Does spin charge separation count for that?
Counts, yeah. So if we want to be more precise about what fractional means, what it means is that a set of quantum numbers for a particle which could not be built up by any collection of the elementary particles of the system, which are electrons, okay. Or spins for that matter. Another sort of way of defining this, which seems very different, but I think is really connected, is a state with some sort of emergent gauge structure. Okay. So it's not obvious what the connection is between these two things, but these at least empirically go together. And these are really the things that make quantum spin liquids interesting. Okay, this is why a lot of theorists find them interesting and waste a lot of time thinking about them and looking for them. Okay. Let me try and give a very, very simple-minded idea of why these might be connected.
The gap of spin liquids
They don't exactly. There's a certain sense in which they fit into this, but I can comment on it, but I know that's what you're most interested in. I want to include them, but I'm sorry. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So none of these things are that clear. So I haven't told you at all what this is. So this is pretty darn vague. Okay. And I actually haven't told you what this is either. And this one I'm not even going to really try and define, but it's it's like art. You know it when you see it. So how are these things connected? At least there's a connection which I would say goes this way, okay? That is that the presence of fractional excitations implies some sort of underlying structure. And at least as far as I know, every instance of this is associated with some sort of gauge-like structure. So why? Basically, the idea is that fractional particles, excitations, have to be intrinsically non-local. Okay. So we can certainly imagine a big chunk of material here, which is some complex thing. It's some quantum spin liquid, or maybe it's a fractional quantum Hall state. That by a miracle of its complicated quantum organization manages to support fractional excitation. So somewhere in here there's some funny particle that let's say carries a charge of a half or something like that, or carries spin without charge, there might be another one in here carrying a charge of, I don't know, also charge of a half, so the whole thing has a charge of an electron, or spin of a half, so the whole thing has spin one. So we know that our whole chunk of material is built up out of electrons, so the total charge of this thing better be an integer multiple of the electron charge. So somehow the presence of just having one here implies somewhere else in the sample is another a half. The system has to know that that globally charge is not fractionalized. There are no fractional charges. Okay. So in particular, you can imagine a thought experiment where I take my sample and I cut it in two here, somewhere far apart, far away from any of these two particles, and somehow when I pull it away again, I have to have an equal number, integer number of electrons on either side. And so somehow in doing this, I'll be forced to create some fractional particles.
Can we look at just a bit differently? Because in principle, this other compensating one half can sit on the surface, so that it's really one quasi particle inside.
That's fine.
The rest on the surface.
That's fine.
Can we then say that somehow this one half should be protected from just dissolving? Because if you have some localized one half, why it's one half rather than any rational number? So there should be some reason this one half be protected.
We can talk about, there's a different question as to whether charges are always multiples of some elementary charge, which itself might be fractional. I'm not sure if that's the question you're getting at. But it's certainly, it's a charge. If it's a conserved charge, then it can't just go away, period, fractional or not.
Right.
So conservation of charge is a different question from fractionalization of charge, I think.
Isn't it true that if you have a charge, it should be somehow protected, so it should be somehow conserved?
It's conserved. Locally. Well, yeah, so we're talking about some conserved charge, like electric charge.
Isn't that the reason for this emergent gauge structure?
No, it's different from, has nothing to do with conservation of a physical quantum number like charge. It's a different thing.
I'm talking about the conservation of the emergent quantum. Because otherwise, why should it be a quantum number? Why should it be a good quantity?
Why should it be a good quantity? Well, by definition, so we're talking about something with which has fractional quantum numbers, right? So why should there be a good quantum number? So quantum numbers, if we talk about quantum numbers rather than statistics is, a little bit more thorny question probably, but quantum numbers, you know, they mean conserved charges, right? They are the eigenvalues of some quantity which commutes with the Hamiltonian, okay? And so by assumption, we're talking about states which don't break those symmetries. They obey some symmetries. We're in a phase which obeys, which is still symmetric. And so we can characterize the quantum states by those quantum numbers. Okay. And if we have particles, then we should be able to characterize them by those quantum numbers.
All right, but as
so we're just using
arrow, somehow you want to relate the emergence of a fractional charge to simultaneously emerging gauge structure, right?
Yeah, so I want to separate fractional physical charge from gauge charge. Okay, I'm trying to make a connection between these two. There's a priori no connection. Okay, like particles in the Laughlin state carry a physical charge of a third, let's say. Okay, that has nothing a priori to do with any sort of emergent gauge charge. That's electric charge. Okay, so I don't know if that helps. But, okay, so there has to be some way in which if I take any closed system, I always get globally no fractional charges. So that this means there's some very strong non-locality. Another way to say it, I mean, it's not doesn't seem the same, but it's sort of related. Is that, of course, this is an unusual thing. Only certain ground states, certain phases will have the property that they can support fractional charges, okay, fractional particles. Many do not. Right? A typical ordered phase of a magnet, for instance, doesn't support any fractional particles. Okay. So if we have some quantum Hamiltonian that we're studying or simulating or quantum simulating in our cold gas, it should be possible to vary some parameter and go from a situation in which the ground state is one of these fractional states to another situation in which the ground state is a conventional state. And in the conventional state, all these fractional excitations have to go away. Okay. So there must be some mechanism. Boy, this is going really slow. Okay. To somehow confine, this is the word we use, confine the fractional particles. And the thing to remember is that actually, in any real sense, in a conventional phase, a fractional particle is not just some high energy state, it's a state with infinite energy. It's really not possible to create a local excitation which carries a fractional electric charge in a conventional material, for instance.
The statement there is what, conventional material?
Yeah. So in a conventional material, actually, these fractional charges should have infinite energy. Okay. And that's actually not in the thermodynamic limit. I mean, so that's actually a non-trivial thing. So the only real way in which, at least I know, that this actually happens, that it achieves both these two things, is for this quantum spin liquid state to have an emergent gauge structure. So gauge theory does this. So maybe it's not essential. Maybe there's some other way to achieve these things that doesn't involve gauge theory, but this is the one we know and seems to happen. I'm not sure if there actually is.
What about the spin one half chain?
Spin one half chain. Yeah. Oh, like one dimension is different. Okay.
And in one dimension, the spin one half chain, the excitation actually is still not a fractional.
on the edge, they cannot propagate, so it's kind of true.
There are fractional, there are fractional spin 1/2 chains, for instance. You take a...
That satisfies exactly all the properties. No, that's the excitation. Here, the definition is the excitation to the chain, carry a fractional charge.
I think certain excitations.
Yeah, there are certainly 1D systems which satisfy these, but it's the structure is different.
Restriction on dimensionality.
Yeah, there's definitely a restriction on dimensionality. Okay. So the way this works, I just want to describe it in physical terms and not describe. There's a lot of mathematics that can go behind it, and I kind of want to avoid it if I can, just to be able to answer some more of these questions. So I'll just kind of give a physical picture for it. And the idea is that in real quantum spin liquids, these physical charges, physical particles, actually are associated with some gauge charge. So every fractional particle also carries non-trivial gauge charge. Okay. So there are various different types of gauge theories that appear in quantum spin liquid states. The sort of simplest one is what's called a Z2 gauge theory, where the gauge charge just can take two values. You can have a charge, which is sometimes we call them charge 1 and minus 1. So 1 is no charge, and charge, non-trivial charge is minus 1. If you want to get a little bit more sophisticated, this is kind of the analog of electric charge. Okay. There are other quantum spin liquid states where this gauge charge is a U1 charge, which means that this electric charge can take any integer value. So 0 again is no charge, but all these other ones are non-trivial charge. What it means is that any particle carrying this charge is actually a source, you should think of it, it's a source of electric flux. And that flux can't start or end, has to go somewhere. So unless, in a closed system, unless that closed system is neutral, then the flux would have to end somewhere. So that's what forces this kind of global lack of fractional charges. Okay. Having this flux means that that is the non-locality. So the gauge theory kind of does this. There are various other interesting things that occur. I just should say a little bit more about this. There are also our magnetic charges. So for instance, in this Z2 gauge theory, you could have a magnetic charge, which also can be 0 or 1, EV. So this is a thing called Z2 gauge theory. You've probably heard of this. It's what's called, people call a bison. And if you transport an electric charge around this adiabatically, it picks up a pi Barius phase. So it's kind of like a vortex for an ordinary charge. So there's all this kind of structure in these gauge theories that kind of implements this non-locality and prevents anything sick happening. So there are some of the questions that were asked were kind of detailed questions about this sort of gauge structure, which I think I'm not going to probably have time to go into in a huge amount of detail, but I want to say a few words about it. So this sounds a lot like symmetry. In a gauge theory, we often think of a gauge theory as something having a local symmetry. But you should remember that this gauge symmetry has nothing to do with physical symmetry. So it's just totally unrelated. To real symmetries. And in particular, it's extremely robust. And what I mean by that is that if this occurs in some model, you can break all the symmetries of that model, and the gauge symmetry will be untouched. So it's a very strange seeming thing. Maybe it's useful to give this one sort of example, which I found very instructive. I can do it in a little bit of detail and then try and move on to some of these other questions. Are there questions at this level? So a kind of interesting, nice example to sort of understand this is the what is called the compact U1 gauge theory. I'm not going to tell you how this is related to any specific spin model. It does come up in various spin systems. But this is sort of one of the simplest gauge theories that can describe certain quantum spin liquid states. So the way it's formulated is you have some lattice. Let's say I can imagine a cubic lattice. And on this lattice, you have electric and electric fields and vector potentials. So you have electric fields. They live on the links of the lattice. I'll draw a square because cube is hard. I can draw a cube. So these electric fields are integers, and then there are some vector potentials, which are periodic variables that vary from 0 to 2 pi. And they obey some commutation relations. These are canonically conjugate to one another on the same link and just 0 otherwise. Okay. And the Hamiltonian is something like a sum on links of EIJ squared. Some constant, and another constant, sum on plaquettes of cosine of curl of A. So the curl is just you take the directed sum of these vector potentials around the link. And these are all vector variables, so EIJ is minus EJI, etc. Okay. So this is the Hamiltonian. Sort of looks like the Hamiltonian of electromagnetism is E squared. This is what you would call the magnetic field, magnetic flux going through a plaquette. If you were to expand the cosine, this would look like B squared, so E squared plus B squared, the usual electromagnetism Hamiltonian. There are physical systems in which the electric field here would actually represent the orientation of a spin that happens to sit on the link of this bond. So this has a gauge symmetry. You look at it, you can see that because it only involves a curl of A. So it has a gauge symmetry, which is that if you, the usual one in electromagnetism, you change this by a gradient, the Hamiltonian would be unchanged. Okay. So in quantum mechanics, the symmetry is always generated by some operator. And in this case, the operator that generates it is really the divergence of E. Okay. At some site, so that's the sum on all the electric fields coming out of a site, like this. That divergence that commutes with the Hamiltonian everywhere, and that so this is actually a local conserved quantity. We know from Maxwell's equations, right? This should just be equal to the charge. So this could just be taken to be some value, for instance, 0 or something. So various different choices give different sorts of details of this gauge theory. So this Hamiltonian, you know, has one dimensionless parameter, the ratio of k tilde over k. So it actually has two phases in it, at least in three dimensions. The interesting phase from our point of view is the phase where k tilde is big. So k tilde much, much bigger than k. So then the biggest term in the Hamiltonian involves this field B and A. So this is going to be, we're going to try and minimize this thing. So A will be a good quantum number. We'll try and make A as sharp as possible. But since A is conjugate to E, E will fluctuate a lot. But so basically, we try and minimize this. And of course, this is minimized when B is 0, when this thing is 0. So in this region, when k tilde is much bigger than k, then we can kind of approximate things by just k over 2 e squared plus a constant plus k tilde over 2 sum on plecats of b squared, curl of a squared, just expanding that cosine. Okay. And this really is the conventional electromagnetism Hamiltonian. Okay. So this goes by the name of the Coulomb phase. Basically, when this parameter, in this parameter range, it behaves just like ordinary electromagnetism. It has a photon that's propagating electromagnetic waves. If you put in test charges, they'll interact with a 1 over r Coulomb potential, all the usual things. Okay. In particular, 1 over r Coulomb potential means that if we have two of our particles that carry this gauge charge, when I bring them far apart, the potential goes to 0, so they weakly interact. That's the non-confined phase. If k is big, it's the confined phase. So this Coulomb phase, that sounds sort of interesting and reasonable. But then you say, well, this A field, if we come back now to kind of thinking about some real condensed matter or AMO situation where this thing might arise in some spin system, A is not a real vector potential, okay? It's some crazy thing that we invented by mapping some system in some way. And E is not a real electric field. So our system has no microscopic gauge symmetry apart from the real one. Imagine if it was a neutral system of neutral atoms or spins, there's certainly no charges there. So why should my effective Hamiltonian have gauge symmetry? You might say, well, this is crazy. Why don't I just, there's no reason why there couldn't be. Why not just add to my Hamiltonian an extra term, which is just A squared? Then there would be a mass for this gauge field, and I wouldn't have the photon, I wouldn't have 1 over r Coulomb potential. Seems to totally destroy the physics. Okay. But the claim is actually that, and it's certainly you don't have any gauge symmetry anymore. Why does that not happen? It turns out this basically can never happen with a weak perturbation. And the reason, the real reason is that the elementary particles charges are discrete. So in real physical situations where this thing occurs, I need to remind you that A here is a periodic variable. And it's periodic because it's the reason that we always find in condensed matter or AMO systems, we have hopping Hamiltonians where a particle can move from one site to another. You can't move half a particle in our microscopic model. Okay, can't move some arbitrary fraction of a particle. So the real perturbations actually involve not A's on their own, but things like e to the IA. And that turns out to be enough. That's all that's needed to protect this state. And you might think that wouldn't do it because, you know, why don't I just add, it's actually OK to add a perturbation like some unbond, some parameter, I don't know. Cosine of aij. This can happen. Cosine 2 aij, I don't know. A number like that. Okay. Not curl of a, right? So again, this doesn't have the gauge symmetry, but at least it's periodic. Okay. So the amazing thing is that if you add a small perturbation like that to this Hamiltonian, it it still behaves as though it has a gauge symmetry. Okay. So this actually doesn't spoil the gauge invariance. So it's weird. So there are various ways to see this. One way is to just try and do perturbation theory in this thing. What you'll find if you do perturbation theory in it is that any term in the perturbation theory which is not gauge invariant vanishes extremely rapidly in the thermodynamic limit because gauge invariance of the original Hamiltonian allows very strong fluctuations of anything that's not gauge invariant. And it gets basically killed extremely fast. Only the terms that survive in perturbation theory are ones which are gauge invariant and don't change the physics. Another way to see it, which is kind of nice, is to make you can make a gauge transformation.
From this would give you a gap to the gauge.
You would think it would give you a gap, but it actually doesn't. Okay. That's the miraculous thing. It doesn't give you
the quadratic
formula. Only qualitatively. It will have changed k and k tilde slightly. It will not gap. Okay. So a way to see it, if lambda is small, if lambda were big enough, it would give a gap. Okay. Lambda big enough, there'll be a phase transition. But for small perturbations, it's stable. So a way to see it is, you know, we're always allowed to make a gauge transformation, so we could change variables if you want to some new variables, say phi minus phi j, like this. And now integrate over these new variables that we introduced. So if we do that, what we actually get is we get h prime becomes something like this. Let me put halves here, because I happen to choose this 2 for no particular reason. Put a minus sign. This becomes a term like this. And so actually what this way to think about this perturbation theory, this perturbation, is it represents a this is like describing a Josephson junction, an array of little superconducting islands, if you want, that are coupled to this gauge field. So there's a sort of physical interpretation is that e to the plus or minus I phi actually creates a particle or an antiparticle with gauge charge 2. In this case, because I happen to choose this factor 2. Okay. This lambda is kind of the strength of this particle's kinetic energy. So when lambda is small, the particle has very, very little kinetic energy. As a consequence, basically, it's not able to propagate. It just goes into its vacuum state or a mod insulating state. So it doesn't condense. This is sort of you want in its vacuum. Or e to the I phi, if you want to think about it like this, is 0. Okay. So physically, you need to give the particle enough kinetic energy for it to condense. Then there's a phase transition. You know, I don't know, if you haven't played with this, you probably won't find it convincing, but you can sit down and start playing with it. And you know, it's really true that well, this is the sort of reason that these gauge symmetries are very protective, actually.
Oh, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Well, I wonder, there is a representation for the partition function of this compact one in terms of the closed surfaces, right?
Sure.
Is it possible to reformulate this argument in terms of this representation, or to see how would you reformulate this argument? Because namely, I would say it's like you're drilling little holes in surfaces, and as long as the hole is small enough, it doesn't doesn't really matter whether you have a closed surface or a surface with a little hole.
Yeah, so it's something like that. So if you want to think in terms of, you can think about it in terms of flux lines which sweep out surfaces in space-time. So if I think about it at a fixed time, okay, in the absence of this term, the flux lines cannot start or end, okay, because you have a divergence-less condition. Okay, this term allows them to start and end. Okay. However, well, they can start and they can end, but that thing costs energy.
The imaginary time direction should not go.
Yeah, it will. If it were very long, it would cost a very large amount of action.
It will translate into the small
holes.
Size.
Exactly, yeah, and those have to get large enough. So that's a kind of partition function picture.
I have a question. I mean, is this gauge protection a property of the continuous symmetry? So if you have exactly the same theory but ZP,
it's also protected. It's even more protected.
It's more protected? Yeah. Why?
Well, there's a gap. I mean, it's a little bit different. But again, it's a similar idea. I mean, again, you have to create, if I add a non-gauge invariant term, I can always rewrite it in terms of a matter field, which in this case carries a discrete charge, and that matter field has to condense before it goes into confined phase. It's a very similar argument works. It's very robust. Let me go to some other questions, if that's all right. Are there more questions about this mysterious thing? It's true, though. All right, some of these questions are a little bit easy. So another question I had was, what's the relationship? This is sort of an easy question at some level. Between spin liquids, and I'm going to read that as quantum spin liquids, and topological phases, these topological states. Okay. Well, I think the relationship is pretty simple in the sense that all fully gapped quantum spin liquids, as far as we know, are topological phases. Okay. So at least for the asterisk means as far as we know. Okay, and it's hard to come up with other examples. So in some cases we can have a reason. So for instance, if we look at systems which satisfy this half integer spin per unit cell, then there's actually a theorem. There's this kind of Hastings theorem by Matt Hastings. That tells us that these systems actually have to have degenerate ground states. On a torus and other complicated geometries. But if they really are fully gapped states with no broken symmetries, it's hard to come up with any other candidate reason for this degeneracy other than this kind of topological order in a topological phase. Now, if you actually look at Hastings' paper, he claims there's actually a proof, which I don't understand, because this paper is pretty hard to understand. I'm not sure if this is, people believe this, people never seem to talk about it. So there's a proof that all local operators so under these conditions, that if you have a half integer spin per unit cell and you have a fully gapped system, full gap to the ground state, that all local operators, if you project them into this degenerate manifold, are some quantity times the identity. Okay, imagine you have three degenerate ground states. You project them into the Hilbert space of those three ground states. You take this operator, any operator that's local, and you project it. You find that it's proportional to the identity matrix. Okay, that's basically the definition of a topological phase. This is claimed in this Hastings paper. So again, I think it's true for all this fully gapped quantum spin liquids we know. Okay, but there's a big caveat that there are many, many, many more quantum spin liquids which are not fully gapped. Okay. They're not gapped, and they're certainly not topological phases.
Okay. So in your definition of topological phase, we always imply ground state degeneracy?
Yeah.
So,
I don't mean, so AKLT does not qualify.
How about for like a topological insulin?
Doesn't qualify.
Question? Yeah. So this projector thing, does this hold for chiral? Chiral spin liquids, like?
I think it holds for any topologically ordered system. Why would it not? Yeah, I think it probably holds within the ground state, the degenerate ground state manifold. I would think, yeah.
So if I understand correctly,
yeah,
this is Pythagoras' definition of topological order. So
yeah,
what he's proving basically is that if you take a quantum spin liquid, satisfying the property.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
What's his definition of a quantum spin liquid?
It's not actually defining. It's a fully, it's a state with a full gap in the bulk. That is a, and on a sphere, probably, with a half integer spin per unit cell. That's a statement. Okay, there are actually some additional qualifiers, but.
So does it start from fractionalization or?
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. There's no connection to fractionalization. It's a, it's a connection between quantum spin liquid in the sense of a lack of order and a gap. Okay.
Sorry, but do you mean that the tiny gapless spin liquid is not topological?
It's not topological in the sense of a topological phase. It's not. Okay. This is a definition. When people talk about topological states, I mean, typically that's what the meaning is. But we could call it, maybe it's topological in some sense, but I prefer to use the word it has some kind of quantum order generically, but exactly what that's. So characterizing in detail what the nature of the kind of structure of the ground state wave function is for a gapless quantum spin liquid is a much more non-trivial thing. And this is, you know, the major problem in actually defining what we mean by quantum spin liquid.
Gapless, then, can you associate a gauge theory for that?
Or? Well, so this is the U1 gauge theory is an example of a gapless one. Okay, so it's In this gauge theory, when k tilde is bigger than k, this Coulomb phase has a gapless photon mode. Okay, so it doesn't have topological order, so it doesn't have a gap. But still, there can be quantum spin liquids and that type. That would be called a U1 spin liquid. There are others. No, simple questions.
Definition of topological order.
Mm.
So there will be phases that are gapless, but they are topological in some areas, some like pure line, and people don't call it topological states.
I don't know. What are you talking about? Give me an example.
For example, you can have a semi metals with some winding numbers, like pure winding numbers.
That's, well, so when you say something is topological, that's very vague. Okay, so there's topological aspects to all kinds of phenomena in condensed matter, right? You have vortices and superconductors. Those are topological defects. We would not call that a topological phase. That's simply, there are certain aspects of the band structure which are characterized by topological invariance. When you talk about a topological state or a topological phase, I think fairly commonly accepted terminology is to call a topologically ordered phase the one which satisfies this.
So topological phase always has a gap.
Always has a gap and has a degeneracy on.
So for those states where it's like a topological ordering due to a correlation but a low gap, you call like Shell would call it a quantum order or something.
quantum ordered or quantum spin liquid of some kind.
Maybe I should add one sentence. So this is almost a top particle order, but there is one set of conditions you need to. So you suppose a top particle order state should be stable under any small perturbation.
Yes.
These conditions are enough to get a theorem. So you need one more extra condition, which is very subtle.
Which is what?
Which is basically saying the ground state has to be compatible locally with global property. I was formulating a paper by Matt Hastings again recently.
Okay, it's mysterious and interesting, and I don't understand it. So there's certainly some locality condition. I should also say all this stuff is true for local Hamiltonians. But
how about what is the image you're talking about? Do you call it topological?
No.
Just the gap.
Not in the same sense.
You can say just
not a topologically ordered state.
The gap doesn't collapse under local small perturbations.
Yeah, that's better.
Yeah. Sure.
So that's.
But that's otherwise it's not a phase.
Yeah. Well, right. No, right. So you need that condition.
Yeah.
This one doesn't.
Okay.
Apply
yeah. Sure.
That one. That
yeah. Yeah. Okay.
On the nitpicking front, I mean, one of the most popular topological phases, the nu equals one third quantum Wolf ferromagnetism on campus.
Absolutely. It's. I agree. I don't know if you should call it a topological phase. Yeah. We can nitpick. And that's why at some point I wanted to say we don't necessarily want to have rigid definitions. But so the phenomena, it's better to talk about the phenomena. But, okay. That's a good nitpicking point. All right, let me get to some more questions here. We're going to go till 5. I think I'll collapse at that point. Feel free to leave. If you all leave, then I can go home.
So I will go home. So I only have your cue me at night.
Okay.
According to Deborah.
Excellent. Okay. All right. So I'll keep running with the simple questions. So there are some subtle ones. There's some interesting subtle ones. I'm just clearly not going to get to them. Don't feel bad if I don't get to your question. We'd be happy to discuss it, or we could have a discussion section some other time next week or something. So there's another question, which is, do people look for quantum spin liquids, or are they always classical? I kind of like that. I wasn't quite sure what this meant, but it's still worth talking about a little bit. So I don't want to write the whole thing. The answer is yes. Yes, they look for them. No, they're not always classical. Yes and no. I guess it's no to this question. So there's a major search for quantum spin liquids. You know, in the context of being pedagogical, I'm going to totally avoid talking about the experimental systems that people are looking intensively at, but they're very interesting. People also look for classical spin liquids, but we can actually ask what we mean by that. In a way, it's not so clear what this means. Is a spin liquid classical? What do we actually mean if a spin liquid is classical? It's a little bit hard to define. Okay, why is it hard to define? Well, it's hard to define because, real spins are our world is governed by quantum mechanics. Okay, not classical mechanics. Okay. You can if you start thinking in terms of models, it's actually not so easy to define this in sort of a realistic situation. So for instance, it's kind of useful to think, formally you can think about this in terms of Heisenberg models with some exchange constant J and some spin quantum number S. Okay. The kind of characteristic ordering scale, this Curie-Weiss temperature, is proportional to JS squared in the Heisenberg interaction, so you have S times S. Quantum mechanics, energy scale, basically, if you think about spin wave theory, occurs at energy JS. Okay. If you want to kind of explore classical physics in a Heisenberg model and avoid quantum mechanics, there's a pretty narrow window. Now, basically, if you want to have a classical spin liquid, you need temperature small compared to this interaction energy. So they have correlated spins. So you need T kind of much less than JS squared. But you want to avoid the quantum mechanics, so P should be bigger than JS. You know, and it's most spin systems, S is 3/2, 5/2. If you're lucky, you can push it up to, you know, 7 or something like that. That's not a big number. So it's not actually much, we put Boltzmann's constant in here, not much room for this to actually work. Okay. People who work in quantum magnetism have a tendency to think that most magnets behave classically because spin wave theory works pretty well to explain the ground state. But ground states are inherently much more classical than magnetically ordered systems are much more classical because the ordering sort of builds up the spin into a large spin. The finite temperature physics is not necessarily very classical. So there are certain cases, and spin ice is one of them, where the Hamiltonian sort of conspires to be more classical. Sometimes we get sort of accidentally classical behavior because, you know, sort of the Hamiltonian involves maybe mostly Ising interactions plus some small perturbations. If for some reason these are the dominant terms in the Hamiltonian, then this is a classical thing because Siz commutes with H for every site. And so these Sis don't have any quantum dynamics. And then at least if you're at temperatures that are sort of large compared to this, or this is a small perturbation to this, you can have a wide range of classical behavior. Okay. And this is the kind of thing that happens in these spin ice systems. But it's kind of special. I'm not sure what the person who asked this question was thinking. One thing they might have been thinking about is that there's a caveat, which is that, you know, we're always going to be studying real systems at some non-zero temperature, and so there should always be some sort of decoherence. And talk about what it means. I don't really want to talk about what it means. Some sort of things that are far away can interact with enough different things that they dephase. And we probably expect that physics beyond some length scale or beyond some time scale, you know, which is probably some inverse power of the temperature, will not be able to be in superpositions with one another. It'll be some sort of decoherent scale. The longest distance physics probably can be described in some hydrodynamical or classical way, non-zero temperature. That's probably true, but nevertheless, most of the phenomena really is quantum in most magnets, I think.
Well, I didn't ask this question. Let me turn it to the one I'd like to ask.
Okay.
Which is, are there any quantum spin liquids?
Are there any? So that was the part of this question. Do people look for quantum spin liquids? You mean in nature?
Yeah.
So there are a number of materials that look very promising. We don't know for sure. Okay. That would be another talk. You can go back and listen to Rajiv Singh's talk here about a month and a half ago, where he talked about various quantum spin liquid candidates in condensed matter. So, and you can decide for yourself whether that's convincing or not. Okay. I think it's promising, but not conclusive. Okay. One of the challenging things, which is an interesting question to talk about, is how do you know? Okay. So there was another question that's along those lines, maybe. That's probably about all I'd have time for, so let me talk about these kind of two related questions. Interrupt me, though, for more. So you probably don't want them to exist. So you want them to exist first in your little box of atoms or cloud. So we had another question, which was, I'm getting tired of writing these down. So how important is it to find a quantum spin liquid ground state versus seeing the physics at non-zero temperature? So t equals greater than zero, quantum spin liquids, is this okay? And specifically they're asking, is it okay to have a system which doesn't order down to a very low temperature, but then below some temperature actually orders? Could we actually see quantum spin liquid physics in such a situation? Okay. So I think the answer is basically, sure, we could. It's not so important that it doesn't order down to absolute zero. But we might as well try to find one that doesn't. So we can ask if that's plausible. Sort of interesting question. So is it plausible to have a system, a material, which exhibits quantum spin liquid behavior over some large temperature range, but then orders at low temperature? So we can kind of think in terms of phase diagrams. You know, conceptually, we should be thinking about it, some system which we can imagine we vary some parameter in the Hamiltonian, and for some value of the parameter, we have a quantum spin liquid ground state. And for some other value of the parameter, it becomes ordered. Okay, this is one situation which this could happen. We certainly have models where this happens. And one way this could happen is that if this were separated by some quantum critical point, so if this were some quantum critical point in between here, this is temperature. So in this situation, actually, probably the answer is no. This is not a good way to observe this, because if we were coming down, it's still observing something interesting. We can imagine our system is here. So at low temperature, it actually orders. This is some ordering line like this. But what we'd actually be seeing above the ordering temperature is not quantum spin liquid behavior, it's quantum critical behavior, which is okay, an interesting thing, but different. But there are other situations. We could imagine the same situation, quantum spin liquid and ordered, but where this point is actually a first order transition. So generically, first order transition at zero temperature will continue into a first order line, maybe with some critical endpoint like this. Okay, who knows what happens. But in this case, we could imagine that if our system is here, then really, you know, above the first order line, the system is in the same phase. It's just a crossing of two states. So up here, this is good. We're basically seeing quantum spin liquid behavior. Okay. There are actually other scenarios that occur in the literature. For instance, this Dirac spin liquid that the MIT group likes. You can imagine if we have here's lambda. If our quantum spin liquid is something more non-trivial, is actually one of these gapless algebraic spin liquids, which is really an interacting critical theory. These can be not as stable as a topological spin liquid. In fact, certain kinds of perturbations can destabilize them and lead to an ordered phase. So this quantum spin liquid, they argued that if you perturb it with Gyalshinsky-Marie interactions, will order. So it becomes ordered with an infinitesimal perturbation. So then we would imagine there's some ordering line here. It's the ordered phase. And again, this is probably this scenario you would expect to see quantum spin liquid behavior. So there's certainly possibilities, but I think the answer is it depends on the details. Okay. Makes sense. I'm just getting tired. One more. So I really wanted to draw this nice picture that Chenka drew on my wall this morning, but I don't think I'm gonna have time for it. That's an attempt to answer your question, Claire. But I won't answer this now because I think it's detailed. Okay, so another question was how to distinguish classical spin liquids from quantum spin liquids at non-zero temperature. Okay, they're both systems which are not ordering. How can we tell the difference? I already discussed a little bit that classical spin liquid is already maybe not so clear why you should really expect it. Real systems are governed by quantum mechanics, but one way to sort of define it is, the idea of a classical spin liquid is that the spins are actually really fluctuating amongst different states. We might want to say that a classical spin liquid is one with, it really has entropy. Okay, so if we want a really hard definition, which is going to be, that is, make it very hard to satisfy, we could say that to have a classical spin liquid, there should be residual entropy. A nice example of this is spin ice, actually. I'm going to keep repeating it because it's almost the only one which is really clear cut. Has actually this residual, people call it T equals zero entropy. But the entropy exhibits a plateau at low temperature, which is not zero. Okay. So it's indicating that the system is still fluctuating amongst real states. Okay. A quantum spin liquid, it's a unique ground state, essentially. It has no entropy. You could try and phrase this in terms of specific heat. Classical, if you actually look at classical spins, if you really strictly take classical spins and ask about the specific heat, the specific heat never gets smaller than a constant at low temperature.
That's
not continuous. Yeah, yeah, well. That's right. On the other hand, in quantum mechanics, it's a question of where you regard the quantum mechanics lying, right? The quantization of the spin itself is some manifestation of quantum mechanics, but you're right. In a quantum system, the specific heat always vanishes. And as far as I know, the quantum spin liquids, they actually can have quite large entropy at low temperature. So theoretically, there is a quantum spin liquid state that has an entropy at a specific heat at low temperature that varies, can be as large as temperature to the 2/3. Other states might have a linear temperature, or quadratic, or exponential. That certainly always goes to zero as temperature goes to zero. So seeing specific heat getting small at low temperature is an indication of freezing out due to quantization of states. Okay, that's not very satisfying. Most systems will do this. Even spin ice will do this. Which is believed to occur not because of quenching of the entropy, but due to freezing. So better indication would be, there are other ways to try and look for the difference. One thing one can look for is that in a classical spin liquid, we should think about the classical spin liquid as one in which there really are local spins. The states are just described by local spins, but fluctuating around. And so in a classical spin liquid, there really are local moments. And they fluctuate, but fluctuate more and more slowly as we cool the system down. So if one doesn't look at a static probe measuring really time average of spins, but averages over some characteristic time scale, you can see these local moments, even if there's no static ordered moments. So this you can see in USR or NMR. These are probably our most sensitive measurements in the solid state to detect local moments that are slowly fluctuating. And there are a number of candidate materials that people thought might be quantum spin liquids, which are basically ruled out by these kinds of measurements. Okay. Conversely, there are measurements which would really tell you that there are quantum mechanics going on. So we would know we have a quantum spin liquid. For instance, if we see fractional particles, so this in principle we can see with neutrons. Another way to see it, which would work for some spin liquids, is if we saw actually quantum interference effects. So in many quantum spin liquid states that we think are sort of reasonable candidate states, these fractional excitations that carry spin are actually fermions, and so they can have quantum interference phenomena like electrons in a metal. Yeah?
Just a comment about the neutrons. If you have strong damping of quasi particles, it will be difficult to distinguish this from having fractional particles. So if you have a non-collinearly ordered magnet or something like this, so if you heat it up,
you have to be quantitative, right? You have to really study the dependence of things on temperature and on wave vector, and really, I think it's, neutron scattering is a really powerful probe, gives a huge amount of information, but it's not something you can analyze without some modeling. But I think in principle, one could have very clear signatures. Now, whether that happens in practice, so far it hasn't actually been that successful in searching for quantum spin liquids, but it has more to do with sample quality, I think, than anything else. Okay. All right, I'm sure everybody's getting tired. There really were a lot of good questions. I will just mention a couple of questions and not explain it at all. There was a very nice question from Sandro Sorella about the PSG classification of quantum spin liquids. Is it valid with charge fluctuations? Yes. Okay. We could talk about it. And Claire Louis had a very nice question about the dedefined quantum critical points in this nail to columnar VBS transition is sort of the one that we, a bunch of us, looked at theoretically. And Chenka gave a very nice talk explaining in one way which that the if you have a staggered VBS, staggered valence bond solid, I think this was your question, wasn't it, Claire? Yeah, that this was not, there could not be the same deconfined quantum critical point between that phase and the nail phase. And you asked for a pedestrian explanation. Evidently, his explanation was not pedestrian. So I don't know if we really have an explanation, but we talked about it, and we can draw a picture. So if you want. There are a bunch of other questions. More or less, I couldn't answer the other questions. So I appreciate your time. I'm sorry. Hope this wasn't too incoherent.